Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Barbara Mather, and I represent BFB, which is the successor to BFI.
Are you going to say, Tom?
Pardon? You're
going to say, Tom?
I am going to say 2 minutes.
Okay. Ms. Mather, we have a very detailed opinion by a district court judge who is now a court of appeals judge. As you, I know you are. Why is it wrong?
It's wrong because when he decided the fraudulent transfer issue and decided that there was reasonably equivalent value to see. He relied on measures of value that were fatally inflated by the overstated earnings and projections that Campbell had provided for the spun-off entity Blessing. Basically, if you read the opinion, the judge is relying on market capitalization right after the spin, and he's relying on several other measures of value, all of which turn on the earnings and the projections were done at the time of the spin.
Well, it seems to me they're turned primarily on stock market valuation, which
right.
is based on what the stock is trading for in the market.
That's right, Your Honor.
What's the matter with that?
Well, the problem with it, as even this judge recognized, and certainly the cases in this circuit have recognized, is that market cap works as a measure of value only if the market has accurate information.
Yeah, well, that's another means to bind another question. Your case seems to be based on the non-disclosure of this product forcing or attempting to sell more product currently than is usual in order for these people to earn their bonus. Admittedly, that or apparently there wasn't any direct disclosure that was going on, but it would certainly seem to me it would enhance the sales and relevant period, and stock market analysts or security analysts could detect that the sales were being enhanced, and they'd ask some questions about why they're being enhanced and call up the customers of the company. I mean, you don't have to have a formal disclosure to the SEC to for the information to get into the stock market.
Well, but, Your Honor, one of the things I think you have to understand about this case is that the judge, in what Judge Slobiter has said, is a very detailed and lengthy opinion, made a number of findings expressly that critical information, in fact, was not revealed to the market. And the law in this circuit, under Moody's principal case, is that projections need to be reasonable, and that the reasonableness needs to be tested by an objective standard anchored in actual performance. Let me talk a little bit about what the judge actually found here. And while the product loading is part of it, Your Honor, it's by no means all of it.
Well, it's the part that you rely on very heavily, though, it seems to me.
I rely on the loading, Your Honor, but I also rely on a number of other things, and they're not things that are just arguments here. They're things that the judge actually found in the record. The judge makes numerous
He didn't find, though, how many dollars were involved in this loading.
No, he didn't.
We're talking about comparative valuations, but maybe there was some loading, but I don't know if it amounted to $100,000 or $50 billion or how, you know. How did it affect the valuation?
Well, the expert for the plaintiffs said that it dropped the EBIT from approximately 130, which is what Campbell's was projecting, into the 50s. And in fact, that's about what Blessing earned in the first year.
Well, apparently the judge didn't believe that expert, didn't he?
Well, that could be, Your Honor, but if we're going to check the testimony against the actual performance, which is what Moody says, there is a significant issue with the projections going out into the market are at 130 million of earnings, and the actual earnings are at 55. The judge made a number of specific findings in the range from 40 to 53 in his findings of fact. He found, as you suggested, that Campbell engaged in extraordinary product loading in 97 and in the 8 months of 98 right prior to the spin. He found that because the Campbell executives had bonuses riding on sales targets, that they undertook to defer trade spending, which is not product loading, Your Honor, it's another issue, sell assets, and load product to meet those targets.
Well, I assume product loading involves discounting primarily, doesn't it?
It involves discount and involves trade expansion, pushing product out into the market, Your Honor. And not only was there loading, which exaggerated earlier earnings, and of course has the effect of making it very difficult to make new targets in the future, because you got a lot of product out there already, but also there was an under-accrual of the expenses that are...
No, but I mean, you force the product on the customers by reducing the price. I mean...
I think in this business, Your Honor, there are actually some movements that change hands for that. But whatever, effectively, it's a price reduction. He specifically found that the product loading artificially increased VFI's earnings in the 12 months prior to the spin, and that the securities market was unaware of that load. He found that VFI's Form 10 filed with the SEC at the spin had not been entirely reliable, because the financial results for Swanson, one of the largest entities that was transferred, had been significantly inflated. Yep. The Form 10 describes a business poised for growth and for acquisitions, but the judge, in fact, found that most of the businesses had declining growth prospects and should be managed for cash. One Campbell executive even referred to them as dogs. The judge found...
I mean, the difference in valuations that he found was... amounted to how much? $500 million, right? The judge said that apparently the consideration placed on these companies that were spun off was $500 million more than their value, didn't it?
The judge said that the market cap was 1.1, Your Honor, and that the transfer was about 500 million.
Well, the difference
fact,
is 500 million, right?
Would have raised it to 647.
Is there any evidence that this market product forcing amounted to a change of valuation of $500 million? I mean, that's what I find lacking in this case. There are a lot of generalities, but there's not much specific evidence of how many dollars were involved.
Well, but the problem, Your Honor, is it's lacking in the opinion below, too. The judge basically makes a finding that we should take that measure that you have accurately stated between the market cap and the debt assumed, and that is the value. The difficulty is, at the same time, he says that the market cap, which obviously turns on the earnings that are being reported in the last year before Campbell spins the company, and on the projections, are not reliable, that they are based on information that is not reported. And there is no quantification in the record of exactly what the effect of that is by the judge. There is ample evidence, Your Honor, that it was very substantial. Housley, the defendant's expert, says that the value of the company was something like $300,000.
Ms. Mather, you've pointed out flaws in the district court's opinion. Now, the standard we have before us is clear error, and it was the burden of VFB to prove not reasonably equivalent. How did the court clearly err in these findings? And by that I mean, what is in the record from an evidentiary standpoint that he rejected in terms of the proof that you offered to prove and show and demonstrate the lack of reasonably equivalent value?
The standard is not clear error, Your Honor.
For his findings on value?
It is clear error for his specific findings, but as the Moody case makes very clear, the issue of what rules to apply and how to apply them to the findings is a matter of law and is subject to plenary review.
But what evidence, what should he have said, aha, I have this to hang my hat on, that this was not reasonably equivalent value because this was the value as compared to this?
The evidence in the record, Your Honor, is Mr. Owsley's discussion of the discounts that needed to be taken from the inflated earnings.
And where in your brief do you bolster and embrace Mr. Owsley's?
Well, I think you'll find it primarily, Your Honor, in the reply brief.
Shouldn't that have been your main thrust? This expert testified to X, and that fulfilled our burden of proving lack of reasonably equivalent value? I mean, I don't think you can just chip away. I think you have a burden here.
We do have a burden, Your Honor, but the judge has a requirement to take the Moody standard, which is to test projections against reality to determine whether they're reasonable. That's what the case says, Your Honor. And if, in fact, his specific findings here say that the earnings were not accurately reflected, then you can't simply go from there to market capitalization and say you have a basis for a determination. The basis is wrong. It's wrong on his own findings. It's wrong as a matter of law in terms of application of Moody. And it doesn't take into account the discounted cash flow analysis that Owsley presented as well.
Where is your Moody discussion in your blue brief? So I must admit I'm missing.
It's not in there.
I think it's in the reply. These are not small differences. The Owsley chart, which is at page 25 of the reply brief, lays out what the actual projections were. Campbell's estimate, which is flawed in all the ways that the judge sets forth in his findings that I've cited to you, was that the EBIT for Vlasic would be $143 million in 1998. The actual EBIT was $55. The projection for 99 is 162. The actual EBIT is 47.
What do you do with the $200 million bond offering in 1999?
Well, Your Honor, this is a situation where, first of all, the $200 bond offering, you need to understand, is a replacement. It's not new borrowing. It's simply a division of the existing borrowing into bonds and bank debt.
Well, somebody bought in
somebody
to,
bought it, Your
to
Honor.
What has to be there after assets are gone.
I agree, Your Honor. The bond debt is was sold prior to what happened here, Your Honor, is that these items, these costs, which had been incurred in the period prior to the spin, were slowly coming out over time. The last one finally appeared in January of 2000. And in January of 2000, the fact that there had been under-recording of trade spending going back all the way into the period before Campbell spun the company was disclosed to the market. The bond debt was
trade spending is something different than product forcing.
It is, Your Honor.
That's an expense item.
It's an expense item, but what had happened, Your Honor, was that it was depressed in the period before, underreported in the period before the spin, which has the effect of inflated earnings. And then in January of 2000, Vlasic had been using the estimates growing out of the prior experience, they finally had to reconcile as a new computer system came up. And when they did that, they discovered that they had trade spending of $15 million that they had to take against earnings. Part of that, and there's testimony by Mr. Adler in the record, $5 to $10 million of it goes back to the pre-spin period. The pre-spin period, when that final disclosure was made, Judge Rendell, the bonds crashed. There was nothing there. These disclosures came out over an extended period of time.
Let me clarify. You represent creditors, not shareholders of VFB.
I represent the successor to the trustee or the debtor. Effectively, I represent creditors. However, Your Honor, it's clear the judge found we had standing. And in addition, under the plan here, Your Honor, we are the successors to the claims of the VFB.
Okay.
If the court has other questions, I'm pleased to answer.
There wasn't any downgrading of the bonds until what the company had been in operating for a couple of years, is that right?
That's true, Your Honor, but the downgrading and the crash of the bonds occurred immediately after the last of the disclosures related to this pre-spin period. And it's not a single item, Your Honor. It is a series of items where Campbell inflated the earnings pre-spin and then used those as a basis of projection. The judge identified many of those, but then he continued to rely upon market values that came off of those very same things.
And the bankers apparently underwrote the bond issue sight unseen. They had so much confidence in the numbers they didn't think they had to audit them. Is that?
Well, Your Honor, like everybody else in this game, they didn't have all the numbers, and that's the problem. And in fact, they didn't have all the numbers related not to later periods, but to the beginning. This is not a hindsight case, Your Honor. This is a case where all of these things were known and knowable at the time of the spin, and they were not reported. You can't rely on market values in that kind of a situation.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Michael Schwartz of the Rocktel Lipton Rosen and Katz firm. I'm here this morning on behalf of Appalese Campbell Soup Company and its affiliates as co-counsel with the Blank Rome firm of this city, with whom we tried the case before Judge Rosen in the District Court. The judge, as Your Honors noted, filed a lengthy, detailed opinion here. The judge did his job of deciding the case that was tried before him. He gave the plaintiff every possible procedural opportunity to prove his case. He devoted 3 weeks of trial time to the trial. He gave him the leave to call no fewer than 5 valuation experts, presumably the 3 they picked were the pick of the litter. And the judge issued detailed findings of fact and conclusions of law in which he decided that the value of the company was $1.6 billion, Your Honor, Judge Cuddy. Almost more than 3 times the amount of debt was assumed in the transaction. There was therefore reasonably equivalent value by a country mile, and the company was obviously solvent by a country mile. The judge, in accordance with this court's instructions in the R&L case, considered...
If the judge was right, Campbell kind of gave these subsidiaries away, didn't
they? They didn't give it away, Your Honor. You have to understand the spinoff was an asset going to Campbell's own shareholders. It would be a totally different matter, obviously, if Campbell was selling it and the upsize were the business was going to go into the hands of a purchaser. But this is a transaction in the family.
They really didn't do anything except structurally freed up the remaining company. I mean, the shareholders kept the value.
See, that's right. The concept was, as Judge Jordan found, that you had pools of assets to acquire very different management styles. There was the Campbell pool of assets with very, very successful brand names, and there were smaller brands that required being managed for cash. And you split those up, the shareholders had both, and they had the upside that was inherent in both. Now, I'm trying to get my arms around exactly what Ms. Mather is arguing. Most of their briefs, both the original and the reply brief, deal with the fraudulent, not with the fraudulent transfer issue, but with the so-called breach of fiduciary duty issue.
But you can't get there until you get determination of the value of the company.
Exactly. No matter what legal theory is advanced here, the key question was, what was the value of assets on the day of the spin-off? That is obviously the key legal issue with respect to the fraudulent transfer case. It's equally the issue with respect to the fiduciary duty case. Because the claim that was being alleged here was that they had standing as creditors. If you look at paragraph 44 of their submission to Judge Jordan in post-trial submissions, they said that the directors had a duty to, quote, foreseeable creditors. New Jersey law, which governs, by the way, all the issues in this case, state law issues, New Jersey law is crystal clear. There's no fiduciary duty to creditors in the absence of quote insolvency. So once again, you're right back to the valuation. And of course, Judge Vendetta is exactly right. This court's decisions are crystal clear that valuation of assets is reviewed for clear error and clear error only. And this court's standard for what constitutes clear error is very high indeed. I'll take the liberty of repeating it. There has to be, find the phrase. Sorry, I just want to get the word exactly right. Completely devoid of a credible evidentiary basis or bearing no rational relationship to supporting data. In honor of Judge Cudahy's participation this morning, I took a look at how they articulate the similar standard in the Seventh Circuit, and it turned out to be a very colorful expression of it.
It would be
clearly erroneous, quote, it must strike us as wrong with the force of a five-week-old, unrefrigerated, dead fish.
We can't import standards.
Is that Easterbrook? Was that Easterbrook?
No, it was Bauer, I think.
Oh, it was Bauer.
You referred to that, Your Honor, as an olfactory response. However the standards articulates, no fair-minded reader of Judge Jordan's decision could say it is completely devoid of credible evidence or bears no rational relationship to the facts presented or smells like a...
Unrefrigerated dead fish, right.
Okay. Now, that, therefore, is the end of the case, both in terms of fraudulent transfer and in terms of fiduciary duty. Because there's simply no basis for this court to reverse those findings. I want to use some of my time here to address some specific points that Ms. Madden made because they are way off the base. In the first place, let's start just with the issue of what happened in this court. In their opening brief, the blue brief, as you call it, Judge Rendell, here's what was not even mentioned. Owsley is not defendant. I mean, his name occurs once in a footnote on page 50-something or other. I'm not sure that doesn't amount to a waiver of their ability now to rely upon Owsley. There are cases in this court which say that if something is not set forth fairly in the opening brief, you can't bring it into the reply brief. So if her evidence is Owsley, I think the court has an issue of waiver. Second, Moody is not only not discussed in the opening brief, it's not even cited in the opening brief. Third, the bond offer is also never mentioned in the opening brief. So in terms of how things happened in this court and the orderly proceedings in this court, it seems to me that this is an appeal that falls far short of any reasonable standard of diligence. Second, she talks about this Moody case, which is, of course, a very important decision on the issue of capital inadequacy. And she says that what Moody requires, her account, is that you have to look for the projections came true in the future. And she quotes language, which is found on page 1073 of 971 F. Second, that the projections, quote, must be tested by an objective standard anchored on the company's actual performance. And in a brief, the words actual performance are in bold-faced type. In other words, a rule of hindsight. Let's see what happened. But if you look at what this court actually wrote on page 1073 of 971 F. Second, it endorsed no such hindsight test. The language of VFB so boldly quotes plainly refers not to the debtor's future actual performance, but to its historical past actual performance, which is exactly what Judge Jordan understood it to mean. If you look at page 1073, right after the phrase they put in boldface twice, this court stated, quote, however, reliance on historical data is not enough. Historical data. VFB never quotes that language.
Where in their reply brief are they citing to that page? I can find it. It's throughout the reply brief, which makes it difficult to find.
Pass him.
Well, it means it's everywhere.
That's the problem.
Well, let me find it.
There's some.
Here it is. I just turned it. I'm having a good morning. Page 14 of the reply.
That's something you can't project. You have to look at it.
It's the afternoon.
Anger to the company's actual performance. Right. And they're reading it to mean future performance. But not only did this court use the word historical data to qualify what it meant by actual performance, but this court, in discussing this precise issue, cited to a leading case on this issue, happens to come from the district court in California, called the credit manager's case. That comes right after the sentence that they are calling an invitation to hindsight. And here's the language in credit managers, which this court was citing. Quote, the court's task in determining whether Crescent had sufficient capital as evidenced by cash flow projections is not to examine what happened to Crescent, but whether the projections as modified were proven. So this whole account of the Moody case that they gave you is absolutely false to what this court held. And it's hard to see how you can miss that. Now, there's a lot of discussion in this math presentation of this loading question. And her account of what the judge did and didn't find about that, with all due respect to this matter, is not reliable. I will walk you through what he did and didn't find. Basically, of course, as Adele has said, this is a valuation issue. So the issue is, what impact on valuation with the loading hat. First finding the judge makes, page A73, from the evidence presented, I cannot determine exactly how much loading occurred and the extent to which it affected those business and financial statements. I cannot determine. They have the burden of proof. If he cannot determine it, they lose. Second, even Housing, their expert, although abandoned by them in their opening brief, made no more of a claim that the pre-spin EBIT was increased by $14.8 million by virtue of loading. That's finding in fact, I'm sorry, conclusion of law 23 on page A74. By the way, our experts' number comparable to that was 3.2 million. But the point that is crucial on the valuation issue is, and if I may say so, Your Honor, Judge Cuddy, this was disclosed to the market. Judge Jordan made a specific finding, it's in conclusion of law 24, that the information in the market was the profit impact was 17.5 million. In other words, higher than the number Mr. Housley used, and of course much higher than the number our expert used. And what was the stock doing when that information was clearly in the market? The market cap of the company was $900 million. With that information, with information in the marketplace, you can bargain a higher number than the one that Housley testified to, or than the other two experts, Tipton and Coleman, testified to. There is a consistent pattern in the opening brief, in the reply brief, and this morning of ignoring a crucial part of Judge Jordan's decision. They argued that certain facts weren't disclosed to the market, and accordingly, the market price wasn't trustworthy. I might add, they did not argue that the market price is not evidence to be looked at. Their point was the particular market price under these particular circumstances was deprived of the information it should have had. Judge Jordan was a very careful trial judge. Obviously, they had made that argument to him. So what did he do? He considered, was there a valuation impact from the information they say should have been disclosed? Wasn't. And he devotes literally 12 paragraphs of his opinion. This is in conclusions of law 22 to 33. To a careful event study, paragraph after paragraph, taking up what the disclosures are, that they should have been, that they say should have been made, the loading, I'm not going to remember all that, but there's a whole litany of them. And concluding that when all these things were unquestionably known to the market, the price of the stock traded at the same level as it did when the stock came out on the spin-off day. Conclusively determining in a careful, dispassionate way that the claim that the price on the opening was too high because of these non-disclosures was unproven. This series of paragraphs, 22 to 33 in the conclusions of law, are not mentioned in the opening brief, they're not mentioned in the reply brief, and they weren't mentioned this morning. They are directly responsive to this core contention. Your Honor, Judge Rendell, one of the earlier lawyers, asked, what's a district judge to do? Well, here is the district judge, listened to the case they put on, made specific findings about it, and for his trouble, he's hailed before this court, and his findings on that precise issue go unmentioned, much less did they establish that those findings were clearly erroneous or smelled like a Seventh Circuit stale fish? I must say, the whole performance here calls to mind the oft-quoted remark of Claire Booth Luce, when she said, no good deed goes unpunished. And here Judge Jordan gave them 3 weeks of trial, five expert witnesses they wanted to actually address all of their contentions, and they make no response at all. Instead, they bring up a bunch of arguments about fiduciary duties, which are, first of all, foreclosed by their failure to establish their valuation phase, as I previously discussed. But there are a bunch of legal arguments that are put forward here, again, particularly in the reply brief, which are totally unsound on their merits, but which were never presented to Judge Jordan. Their presentation, at least in their briefs, is permeated with arguments that were never made to him. My time is running short. I'm not going to take a lot of time going through them. A good rule of thumb, Your Honors, is this. If they're arguing something, and there's not something about it in Judge Jordan's opinion, it's because they didn't ask him to decide. In particular, they tell you in their reply brief there's some big important issue with New Jersey law that you have to decide with respect to whether or not New Jersey would or would not follow the Anadarko case of the Delaware Supreme Court. Well, first place, no such argument was made to Judge Jordan. The Anadarko case is not even cited. The judge let each side file 150 pages of post-trial, proposed conclusions, and findings. The Anadarko case is not even cited by them in any of their proposed findings. Second of all, the argument which asks this federal court to decide a novel question of New Jersey corporate law is not properly before the court for another reason. Because regardless of what the New Jersey rule may be in the Anadarko situation, the Francis case, which the judge did rely on, the decision of the Supreme Court of New Jersey, unanimous, recent, thorough, well-reasoned, says that there is no fiduciary duty owing to creditors in the absence of insolvency. And Anadarko has nothing to do with insolvency.
Would you comment on your claims against the bankruptcy?
Yes, we have filed unsecured claims. Let me see, I have a little list. Based upon liabilities of BFI under the separation and distribution agreement, that was the contract under which the spinoff was conducted. We also had various...
What kinds of claims were really at issue there?
Well, can I proceed?
Well, obviously, I have to do an answer to the question.
Okay. There are, for one thing, indemnity claims. Under the separation and distribution agreement, they were foreclosed from challenging the transaction on breach of fiduciary duty grounds, which, of course, is what their whole presentation has been in this court. We also supplied them with goods and services, and there are unpaid receivables, the monies advanced, and so on. That's the nature of our claims.
Okay.
They're
not claims that preceded the spinoff, or are they?
No, they're claims that follow.
Okay.
Except insofar as they arise under the spinoff agreement itself.
Did you have any questions of him? Thank you. Ms. Mather? I know that you have a reply, but could you just briefly address this claim business? Why
they shouldn't be allowed?
Yeah, why they shouldn't have been allowed. I know you're focused on the other issue.
I'm focused totally on.
Okay, go ahead.
Let me collect myself in just a second.
Well, why don't you talk about what you were going to talk about, and then
but
if
then
you catch up, point. Yeah.
Okay. Let me just, Your Honor, I apologize for the order of citation in the brief, but Moody is cited and discussed at length in the reply brief, and it does not, as my worthy opponent says, speak only of past data. It talks about projections, and it says, because projections tend to be optimistic, their reasonableness must be tested by an objective standard anchored in the company's actual performance. What was wrong here was not only that the company's projections were ludicrously high, more than double what they made, but in fact that they were, in addition, grossly inflated in many ways that the judge in fact found in the actual performance period prior to the spin.
But what was the value that you proved?
We had two valuation experts, Your Honor. One was Owsley, who put a value of $250 to $300 million.
But if you didn't argue in your opening brief that his valuation was so unassailable and so excellent that it was clear error for the judge to look elsewhere, why should we give any credence to that concept?
It is, Your Honor, I don't believe this case is to be decided under a clear error basis. The judge had a number of valuations before him, almost all ones that he
What is the standard?
The standard is, as Moody lays out, if he applied the wrong test,
No. It has to be clear error, abuse of discretion, de novo. We have to have some standard, review standard. De novo?
No.
Well, that's plenary. That's plenary.
Question, Your Honor.
Well, there you go. That's the one where if you don't know what it is, you say that's what it is.
Well, that's what Judge Sirica said, Your Honor. I'm not making it up.
Well, it may be mixed, but finding a value of X is a factual determination.
Not if you use projections that are not rooted in reality. And that's exactly what Moody says, Your Honor. And it also says, very expressly, Judge Sirica writing, that if that the analysis of what test to be applied and how it is to be applied is an issue that is plenary review.
Well, I have to tell you, I really didn't review Moody's that carefully in connection with this case because it wasn't cited in the blue brief. And I think it's really, I'll go back and look at it again.
Well, what's the specific relation of projections to valuation at the time of the spinoff?
Pardon?
What is the specific relation of projections to the value of the subsidiary at the time of the spinoff?
When Campbell spun the company, it did a series of, first of all, it had data from the last year.
Yeah.
97, yeah. And partial data for 98, and those were inflated in the very ways that the judge stated, and that information was part of what the market had. In addition to that, there were projections that were done by Campbell at 130 plus million for earnings for a company that in fact earned 55 in the first year after the spin, two-thirds of which was actually under Campbell's management.
So your thesis is the market accepted these numbers without further inquiry.
I think it's obvious the market accepted these numbers without further inquiry, Your Honor, for the very reason that you stated.
You have a rather naive view of
this.
Your case has a rather naive view of the stock market, in my opinion.
But here the judge expressly found, Your Honor, that there was a lot of significant information that wasn't in the market. His very own finding to say that, and he doesn't go back and address that issue when he simply relies on the market. You asked about the bankruptcy issues?
Yeah, well, because it's in your brief. I mean, you say that the district court shouldn't have accepted that.
Yes, there is an issue. One of the bankruptcy issues is whether certain of the claims had been objected to below. And we asked the judge to reconsider that, and he said no, we probably feel late. And one of the other issues...
Did he error in doing that, or abuse his discretion?
I think so, Your Honor. The case has been tried all the way on regular federal rules of civil procedure. We appeal in a standard federal rules time period. And there had been at least some objection on the record to the claim.
But there's no claim that they weren't... There's no claim that they weren't actual arm's-length obligations, is there? That they were, you know, because of the relationship, they should be seen as equity or anything else. I'll look at it.
Yeah, okay. That's fine. Anything else?
Any other questions?
Nothing. Okay, thank you very much.
You.
Case was very well argued, well briefed, and we will take it under advisement.
Thank you, Your Honor.